Today we'll turn to Psalm 105. 105 and 106 are both relatively long psalms compared to most of the ones that we've studied. Psalm 105 has 45 verses and Psalm 106 has 48 verses. And these psalms have something in common with each other. Both of them give a running, selective history of the Jews, including a discussion of the escape from Egypt and the wilderness wanderings and the various dealings of God with the Jews in the wilderness, as well as going beyond that to later times in their history. Now, as with some of the other psalms we've seen, this is not just history for the sake of interest, but it's history with a purpose, with a lesson to be learned. In Psalm 105, it's almost entirely positive. It's almost entirely a recitation of the good things God did to the Jews, how he kept his promises in spite of many adverse circumstances that would have seemed as though they would oppose God's fulfillment of the promises, yet God faithfully fulfilled every promise that he made. So that in Psalm 105 we have the faithfulness of God laid out for us through the historic events that are recorded in Jewish history. In Psalm 106, on the other hand, we have roughly the same period of time of history, at least some overlapping of the same period of time of history recorded, but from another angle, not stressing so much God's faithfulness as the unfaithfulness of the people. Someone has taken these two psalms and given them these titles. Psalm 105, they've called, "Not One Thing Has Failed." And Psalm 106, they called, "But Not One Lesson Was Learned." Meaning that not one of God's promises failed, which is demonstrated in the history recorded in Psalm 105, but not one lesson was learned by the Jews through it, as illustrated in Psalm 106. So we'll go through this, and I will try to refresh your memory on some of the stories that are alluded to here. Of course, the readers, being Jewish, would have heard these stories again and again and again and again as they were growing up. And therefore, the psalmist sometimes just alludes briefly to something, and that allusion to a Jewish reader would bring a whole wealth of detail of the whole story. They'd remember it. Now, that may be true with you also, since most of us have just been through the historic portions of the Old Testament, and a lot of these stories will still be fresh in our minds. But for those of you who aren't as familiar or might have forgotten some of these things, I'll try to fill in some of the details so that you'll get the idea of what is being recalled here. The opening verses are an exhortation to the people of God to talk of God's wonderful works, to talk of all the good things he's done. And the remainder of the psalm is the psalmist's own attempt to do just that, to talk of all God's wondrous works. The idea being that if we have received a great deal of blessing from God, we shouldn't just keep it to ourselves. We should tell others about it. We should, in fact, make these things an opportunity to testify the goodness of God to those who have not yet learned his goodness. If we have learned by experience that God is good, we need to communicate that to those who have not yet had that experience so that they might learn to trust him also. And that's what the opening verses say. And before we read them, I might just call your attention to one verse in Psalm 107, which 107 verse 2 says, "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he hath redeemed out of the hand of the enemy." Psalm 107, verse 2. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so. Redeemed out of the hand of the enemy. Meaning that if God has given you deliverance and from some trial, from some attack that was overpowering you, and God saved you out of it, well, then you ought to talk about it. You ought to say so. Because there are people who are going through those kinds of problems right now who have not learned by the same experience you've had to trust God. And therefore, the recounting of his victories, the recounting of his faithfulness, is to inspire faith in us as we retell it. It calls it to our own remembrance because we are often forgetful of such things. And also it communicates the faithfulness of God to others. Remember in Psalm 89, I think it was verse 2, that the psalmist said, "With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations." Let me give you that verse Psalm 89, it's actually verse 1, the latter part of verse 1 of Psalm 89. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. So the idea is that verbally we can make known to other people, to all generations in fact, the faithfulness of God. Now the faithfulness of God is a lesson that he wants all people to know. There is so little faithfulness among men. There are so many people who've come to a place of cynicism who believe that no one can be trusted. And in the realm of men, this may be actually true. Paul said, let God be true and every man a liar. So it is possible that every man that you've ever met or ever will meet will be in some way or another dishonest, may let you down. A lot of times men will not be consciously trying to deceive, but because of human frailty will accidentally give the wrong impression or something and will, you just can't trust men, but you can trust God. And that's a hard lesson for people to learn, because once people have been burned by men sufficiently many times, they just develop a habit of doubt. I won't believe it until I see it, kind of a thing. That's how Thomas was. Even when his own best friends, the other apostles, said, we've seen Jesus alive. Well, he no doubt had never found them untrustworthy witnesses, but it just seemed like that was such a radical statement that he just figured he couldn't believe it, because even though it was testified to him about that. But of course, the thing that needs to be, people need to be reprogrammed, really, to learn to trust, not to trust men necessarily, although we need to establish a certain level of trust in trustworthy people so that we don't, you know, live our lives totally in fear of what, you know, being deceived or whatever. But certainly men need to learn to trust God, and that is done when people learn that he can be trusted. Now, the first stages of learning that is by being told. When you hear the testimonies of people who experienced tremendous deliverance in financial matters where they were facing a crisis or of great sickness or of some other great problem that they were facing and God came through, it gives you encouragement. But not anywhere near as much as after you've seen it happen in your own life. But still, to tell others of the faithfulness of God is the first stage in developing a trust in God among your listeners. And that's what this psalm is for. It's to recount the faithfulness of God. And the opening verses, as I said, basically tell us that we should be talking about these things. We should be telling people, even among the heathen, it says, to sing about his wondrous works. It says, oh, give unto the Lord, or give thanks unto the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him, sing psalms unto him, talk ye of all his wondrous works. So both of those verses begin with an exhortation to praise God or to sing unto him, and end with a statement that we need to communicate to other people the things that he has done. In fact, we might even consider that praising him is, or that telling of all things done is part of praising him. Talking of all his wondrous works is part of our praise to him. It certainly brings praise and glory to him to do so. Glory ye in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice that seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face evermore. Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders and his judgments of his mouth. O ye seed of Abraham, his servant, ye children of Jacob, his chosen, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations. Now, when it says he remembered his covenant, whenever it refers to God remembering something, it always implies that there's some action on his part. When it says that he remembered Noah after the flood, and Noah and his family had been in the ark for so many days, it says, and the Lord remembered Noah. And so he caused a wind to come to cause the waters to recede and so forth. When God remembers, it means that he remembers, and it doesn't mean that he forgot. What it means is that his actions show that he has not forgotten. And so here when it says he remembered his covenant, it means that he has shown us that he has not forgotten his covenant. He's been faithful to live up to the things he promised to a thousand generations. Which covenant he made with Abraham. Now here's where we get into the history. Abraham was the first one to whom this covenant was communicated by God. He made a covenant with Abraham, and his oath was unto Isaac. And he confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant. Now, in these two verses, several hundred years are covered, the generations of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God first made his covenant promises to Abraham, that he would bless him, make his name a blessing, make him a great nation, bless all nations through him and through his seed. These were the things that were communicated to Abraham. And they were also repeated by God to Isaac, his son, and later to Jacob, his son. So that for three generations, God personally communicated the covenant to these men who were of the line of Abraham. And then when it says unto Israel, it either is the same as Jacob, because Jacob's name was changed to Israel, or very possibly at the end of verse 10, it's referring to the nation Israel, which came from Jacob's 12 sons. At any rate, it says, saying, this is the covenant, unto thee will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance. That was part of the covenant too. He was going to give them this promised land. When they were but few men in number, yea, very few, and strangers in it. That is, when God promised that they'd own the land someday, they were just a few people. And they were foreigners in the land. They were just passing through, really, or passing around in it, traveling around, living as nomads, even though there were established communities of Canaanites in walled cities throughout the land, and the land was owned at that time by the Canaanite peoples. Abraham and his sons were transients in the land. They were just passing through. Yet, while they were in that state, greatly outnumbered by the Canaanites, and certainly not appearing to have any claim on the land at all, yet at such a time as that, God promised them, and they believed his promise, that that land would someday be theirs. It says, when they went from one nation to another, and from one kingdom to another people. We might get the impression of nations as we think of today, a large political entity spreading over much ground. But in fact, in those days, each nation was within a walled city. They were city states, so to speak. Each city had its own king and therefore was an autonomous nation. And the cities would fight with each other like nations, but they were little city kingdoms with each having their own king. And Abraham and his sons wandered around among these nations, among these cities. He suffered no man to do them wrong, but he reproved kings for their sakes, saying, touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm. Now, what that refers to is the fact that when Abraham and Isaac sometimes went into the Philistine territory, or on one occasion Abraham went into Egypt, once was in Genesis chapter 12, where Abraham went into Egypt, and in Genesis chapter 20, he went into Philistine territory, into Gerar, and then later his own son Isaac went into Philistine territory again. For one reason or another, they went out of their land, usually because of famines. You remember, lied about who their wives were, said their wives were their sisters, so that they felt that would save their own lives by saying so. But in each case, whenever one of the kings would take either Sarah or Rebekah to be a wife, God would rebuke those kings. In one case in particular, in the case of Abimelech in Genesis 20, God actually spoke to Abimelech and said, give this woman back to her husband Abraham, for he is a prophet, and don't do him any harm. And so this is sort of a paraphrase of that statement, where in verse 15 it says that God rebuked kings for their sakes, saying, touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm. Because God had spoken to Abimelech, and said that Abraham was a prophet. Moreover, he called for a famine upon the land, and he broke the whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, whose feet they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron until the time that his word came, and the word of the Lord tried him. The king sent and loosed him, even the ruler of the people, and let him go free. He made him lord of all his house and ruler of all his substance, to bind his princes at his pleasure, and to teach his senators wisdom. Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land with him. Now, what this refers to is the fact that even though God sent a famine, as is mentioned in verse 16, in the land of Canaan, he had already prepared the way for the Jews to be delivered through the famine. He had sent Joseph on ahead in an unusual way. He caused Joseph to be sold into slavery by his brothers. And Joseph spent time in jail. In fact, it was about 12 years later or more, actually 20 years later, I guess it was more like 17 or something like that, Joseph actually was raised up to power in Egypt and was able to deliver his family from the famine by bringing them into a favored position in Egypt. That's what's mentioned here. So it says that even though he called for a famine in verse 16, yet in verse 17 he had sent a man before them, even Joseph. So God faithfully looked out for them. Even though he tried the land with a famine, he knew he would do that. Therefore, he prepared a way for them to go into Egypt by sending Joseph ahead. Now, about Joseph, in verses 18 and 19, it says his feet were hurt with fetters. That's a bit of graphic detail that was not mentioned in the Genesis account, but that he was actually pinched with shackles around his legs as a servant and a slave. But it also says, until the time that his word came, and the word of the Lord tried him. Now, that clearly is talking about the time he spent in jail, because it says in verse 20, the king sent and loosed him and let him go free. So during the time that he was in jail, it said that he was there until his word came, probably referring to the prophecy that God had given Joseph in dreams before he was ever sold into Egypt. When he was at home with his family, God gave him two dreams. One was about the sheaves bowing down to his sheep, and another was about the sun, moon, and the stars bowing down to him. Both of these basically implied that his 11 brothers would someday bow down to him. And he had that as a word from the Lord. Remember, we've talked about the death of a vision before. That was his vision. He had this vision of ruling and actually his brothers bowing down to him. The Lord gave him that vision. But then the word tried him. He was tried by, the word was tested, really, and it tested him to see if he would still hang on to that promise even when he was in prison. And it seemed like it was the furthest thing from a potential reality at all that his brothers would ever worship him. In fact, it didn't seem like he'd ever get out of jail. So during that time, he was waiting for the word to come true. And the word was trying him in a sense. That is, he had a word that he could hang on to or else he could give it up. He could either keep his faith in that word or not. And the very presence of that word sort of gave him something that he could either believe or not believe, and it tested his faith a great deal to have that promise at the same time that he's going through such a testing. And whether he died to that vision or not fully, we don't know, but we know that it certainly looked like that vision was not going to come true. So we see that not only was God sending Joseph ahead to spare the people, God had other purposes in mind that had to do with Joseph's own life. He was testing the man, increasing his faith, and so forth. And we can see that God always has more than one thing he's doing in a situation. He'll work in your life individually, and he'll work in someone else's life individually, and in the relationship you have with the other person, he'll bring some third result about, because he's working on so many different levels. In this case, he was working to save the people of Israel, but he's also working in Joseph's life, and no doubt dealing with those people in prison that Joseph had to do with also. Now, after referring to Joseph being loose from prison, it mentions that he called Jacob and the brothers to come live with him there. And it says, and Israel also came into Egypt, verse 23, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. Remember, the Egyptians were descended from Noah's son Ham. And so that's what's referred to there. And he increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies. This is exactly what Exodus chapter 1 says. The Pharaoh noticed that the Jews were multiplying in the land so fast that they were beginning to outnumber the Egyptians, and it frightened him, so he made them slaves. And so it says they became stronger than their enemies, meaning stronger in man numbers and all. He turned their heart to hate his people, that is, God turned the Egyptians' heart to hate the people, to deal subtly with his servants. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. They showed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. Now we have a listing of some of the plagues that were sent. Not all 10 are mentioned, but quite a few of the plagues are referred to here. He sent darkness and made it dark, and they rebelled not against his word. He turned their waters into blood and slew their fish. Their land brought forth frogs in abundance in the chambers of their kings. He spake, and there came all sorts of flies and lice in all their coasts. He gave them hail for rain and flaming fire in their land. The reference to flaming fire is a reference apparently to the ball lightning that came along in Exodus 9:23. Associated with the plague of hail, it says, and the fire ran along the ground, and lightning ran along the ground. And There is a phenomenon which I don't understand much about, and I'm not sure if anyone does. Probably there are some people who do, but it's called ball lightning. And in certain parts, I think in the Midwest and places like that, where electrical storms have different phenomena than we've seen around here, where actually an electrical storm, an actual ball of fire or of lightning can form and run or roll along the top of a fence or something, or roll along the ground, and it'll hit a tree or something, and the tree will just explode into flames. It's just an amazing phenomenon, and it's not all that uncommon in certain parts of the country to see these kinds of things. And that's apparently what was happening, because in Exodus 9:23, it mentions that during the plague of hail, that the lightning or the fire ran along the ground. And that's what seems to be referred to in verse 32 here. It says, he smote their vines also and their fig trees, and brake their trees and their coasts. This was in the plague of hail. He spake, and the locusts came, and caterpillars, and that without number. Now, there's no mention in Exodus of caterpillars, but caterpillars was a name for another name for the larva of locusts. In the book of Joel, there's mention of four different stages of the development of a locust, and a caterpillar is one of the stages of development of the larva. So it's referring here to the fact that locusts came, and not only one generation of locusts, but they were there apparently long enough to have offspring also. The caterpillars, or their larvae, were laid there. And that without number, that it eat up all the herbs of the land and devoured the fruit of their ground. He smote also all their firstborn in the land. This was the tenth plague, which the Passover was associated with the death of the firstborn son. The chief of all their strength is a reference to the firstborn. He brought them forth also with silver and gold, and there was not one feeble person among their tribes. The silver and gold was given to them by the Egyptians. By the time the ten plagues had run their course, most of the Egyptians, unlike Pharaoh, were quickly eager to get rid of the Jews. I mean, they realized that the plagues were coming on them because the Jews were there. Pharaoh's heart was hardened, so he didn't think the way that his own people did. But most of the people were just eager to get rid of the Jews. And so Moses told the Jews the night before the Passover to go and ask, demand from the Egyptians gold and silver and jewels and various things from them, which later were used by the Jews in the wilderness to build the tabernacle and the furniture of the tabernacle. But actually, the Egyptians were glad to give the Jews anything they asked for, just to get them to leave, pay them to go, really. And it wasn't really theft on their part to do this, or it wasn't extortion for the Jews to do this, you know, threaten that these things are going to happen if they don't give them gold and silver, because it was actually God who told them to do it. And this was perhaps back wages for 400 years of free labor the Jews had given the Egyptians as slaves. They were just getting paid back only a small percentage of what they ought to be paid for all the labor that had been exacted from them. And those things were then consecrated to God later on. Well, anyway, it says they went out with silver and gold. It says there wasn't a feeble one among them, which must mean that God supernaturally had each of them healthy on that particular night when they had to flee through the Red Sea. They needed all their strength, and God kept them strong. We're told elsewhere that in their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, their clothes didn't wear out and their shoes didn't wear out, which obviously was a supernatural provision for them also. It says Egypt was glad. Oh, well, let's see. Is that where we are? Okay, yeah. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the fear of them fell upon them. He spread a cloud for a covering and fire to give light in the night. The people asked, and he brought quails. Now, this was after they crossed the Red Sea. They got quails out in the wilderness. You remember that story, and a plague followed that. And he satisfied them with the bread of heaven. That's a reference to manna. He opened the rock, and the waters gushed out. They ran in the dry places like a river. That's a reference to when Moses smote the rock, and the water came out of it. For he remembered his holy promise, and Abraham his servant, and he brought forth his people with joy and his chosen with gladness, and gave them the lands of the heathen, and they inherited the labor of the people. Now, the heathen are the Canaanites. He gave the Jews their Canaanite property, and they inherited their labors, which means, of course, that the Jews didn't come into some barren wilderness and have to cultivate it. When they took over these cities, there were already houses built, there were already fields cultivated. They just kind of walked in and took over the labors of others. Now, of course, that might seem not very ethical, but when you realize that God's purpose was to judge the Canaanites,
and God was certainly justified to do so, they were a very exceedingly wicked people, then it's God's privilege to give their properties and everything to whoever he wants to. In fact, in the Proverbs, it says that the wealth that is laid up by the wicked will be given to the righteous. And that's more or less what happened to the Canaanites. They cultivated the land. They lived in it for hundreds of years. They did wickedness in the sight of God. God judged them, drove them out of the land, and destroyed many of them, and gave it all to the Jews. So the Jews were able to just walk onto ready-made farms and houses and so forth, and cities, so that they inherited the labor of the other people. And it says, and that they might observe his statutes and keep his laws. Praise ye the Lord. Now you can see that this recounting of the faithfulness of God in Israel's history begins with a particular promise that he gave to Abraham that's mentioned in verses 9 through 11. It points out that God made the covenant to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he would give them the land. It also tells us in verse 12 that when he made this promise, it was not likely in the natural that it would ever come true, because the land was inhabited by mighty nations that were opposed to the Jews. The Jews were few in number. They were just wanderers in the land, yet God made such a promise that seemed unlikely of fulfillment in the natural. And the rest of the story, up to the end, leads up to the fact that God did give them the land. That's what he says in verse 44, and he gave them the lands of the heathen. So the idea here is to show that God made a promise to give his people the land, and the history that follows shows that these are the steps that were taken in order to do so. Now, when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were given that promise, they were in the land of Canaan. But God apparently wanted to weaken the Canaanites in one way or another by sending famine. So he sent Joseph ahead of the people, ahead of his family, to Egypt and prepared a place for the Jews in Egypt. In the land of Egypt, he allowed them to come under the oppression of the Egyptians, which was not inconsistent with his faithfulness, because it was part of their training too. It was realized that they needed some great deliverance in order to really cause them to see their need for God. They needed to have trouble. If he had just called Abraham out, and just by a slow and gradual process, it became a great nation, they would have no climactic deliverance in their history to look to as the time when God showed his power to them and gave them something to be grateful for. Because that's, of course, we know that after the deliverance from Egypt, the Jews always look back to that as their 4th of July. That was their birth of their nation. And it was a birth that came about by supernatural deliverance from God. And we know now that God even did it in the way he did in order to give a typical picture of our bondage that Jesus delivers us out of, because the New Testament tells us that Jesus is our Passover lamb, which, of course, the Passover was what delivered them out of Egypt. There are various comparisons made in the New Testament to our deliverance from sin that are drawn from images from the deliverance from Egypt of the Jews. So the whole thing that God did with the Jews in Egypt and the deliverance, he did as part of his faithfulness to them, but also, of course, painting a picture for us to foreshadow certain things that he would do later through his son Jesus. But the point is that it goes through the details that even though they were in Egypt for 400 years as slaves, yet God remembered his covenant. He came and he sent plagues on Egypt. He caused them to be delivered. They went out wealthy, even though they'd been slaves for 400 years. They went out wealthy with silver and gold. He gave them food when they were wandering through the wilderness. He gave them quails. He gave them bread. He gave them water out of the rock. In other words, just a recounting of all the faithful things God did to show his favor upon those people, and finally ended up with him bringing them into the land. As I said, Psalm 106 goes over some of the same territory, over some of the same historical information, but with a different lesson in mind. And that is to show that even though God did all these things, the Jews never really obeyed him. They never really learned to obey him and to trust him. And that was something that the Jews themselves recognized. This is not an anti-Semitic statement. It's written by a Jewish poet. Whoever it was, we don't know who wrote it, but it was clearly a Jewish piece of writing. And the Jews of later years recognized that much of their woes had come about because of their own rebellion and stubbornness and refusal to learn from God's goodness to them. And so here we have this other history, approximately the same length. Begins, praise ye the Lord, O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. Now, this particular statement, O give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever,
is found in quite a few of the Psalms, actually. In fact, a number of the Psalms begin with this statement, and some of them actually have it as a continuing refrain. I didn't plan to use it, so I didn't find it. Oh, here it is. Psalm 136 is an interesting example, because Psalm 136 starts out with the same phrase, "I'll give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." And then every verse after that ends with, "for his mercy endureth forever." It's like a refrain that's taken up again and again and again. When God sent the Jews under Jehoshaphat out with their musical instruments to fight a battle without weapons in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, they went out and they were to sing praises to God rather than to go out and fight with weapons. And they were to, and of course you probably remember us alluding to that story or remember studying it yourself, how that they actually, God turned the, actually turned the army of the aliens against themselves so that the Jews didn't have to even fight. But in description of the singing and the praising of God that they sang, it's in 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 21. 2 Chronicles 20, 21, it says, "And when he had consulted with the people, he appointed singers unto the Lord that they should praise the beauty of holiness as they went out before the army and say, praise the Lord, for his mercy endureth forever." That was essentially what they sing. "For his mercy endureth forever. For his mercy endureth forever." We find that Psalm 139 takes up this as a refrain. Every verse ends with, "for his mercy endureth forever." Here we have it at the beginning of this psalm, and we'll find it at the beginning of other psalms as well. It was clearly one of the great confessions of faith and one of the great praises of God, that his mercy endureth forever. The word mercy to us usually speaks of forgiveness, or extending to someone forgiveness when they don't deserve it, or maybe showing some kindness to them that they don't deserve. That's, of course, fair enough. Most of the new translations have changed the word mercy to steadfast love. Seems to be the preferred translation of the Hebrew word, changing it from mercy to the steadfast love. And that's many times the case. In the Old Testament, the word mercy is a Hebrew word, which the translators now believe is better translated the steadfast love. That is the unchanging love. Steadfast means it's immovable. God's basically his unconditional love. There's a song, "The steadfast love of the Lord endureth forever," of course, is a line that we have in some of the songs that we sing. And that's taken from this very thing. And it was the very thing that the Jews sang as they went out to face the armies of the aliens. And the Lord honored them and gave them victories. Well, this psalm begins that way. "Praise ye the Lord. O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy," or his steadfast love, "endureth forever. Who can utter the mighty acts of the Lord? Who can show forth all his praise?" Now, in Psalm 105, it said, "Tell of all his wondrous works. Speak of all these things." But now he says, really, who can tell the whole lot of it? There's so much that God has done that even though we would seek to speak of it and tell of it, we can't do it justice. Which of us can remember all the good things God has done? Which of us could really frame the right words that would really portray the excitement and the greatness of the occasion that, as you know, those who experienced it knew? Who can really tell these things? Who can utter the mighty acts of the Lord? Who can show forth his praise? Blessed are they that keep judgment, and he that doeth righteousness at all times. Remember me, O Lord, with the favor that thou bearest unto thy people. O visit me with thy salvation, that I may see the good of thy chosen, that I may rejoice in the gladness of thy nation, that I may glory in thine inheritance. Now he begins his historic account. And he starts out with a summary of what he's about to illustrate. The summary is, we have sinned. That's really what the whole psalm is going to be about. We've sinned. We haven't obeyed you. And then he goes on to illustrate how much they've sinned and how many times God gave them opportunity not to sin, but they sinned anyway. We have sinned with our fathers. We have committed iniquity. We have done wickedly. Our fathers understood not thy wonders in Egypt. They remembered not the multitude of thy mercies, but provoked him at the sea, even the Red Sea. Now, in Psalm 105, it listed some of the plagues that God did in Egypt to show his faithfulness to the Jews to bring judgment upon the Egyptians. Now it says, even though God did those wonders in Egypt, that is, in sending plagues on the Egyptians, the Jewish fathers didn't understand. Now, it doesn't mean that at the time they didn't appreciate it. It simply means that it did not really teach them a lasting lesson. Because even though they appreciated God's deliverance at that time and rejoiced in those plagues that were sent on the Egyptians to deliver them, nonetheless, it was soon forgotten. They didn't really learn the lesson of God's faithfulness. Sort of like Jesus, when he was crossing the Sea of Galilee with his disciples, he said, "Beware of the leaven of the scribes and Pharisees and Herod." And the disciples said, "Oh, it's because we didn't bring bread," because they didn't know what he was talking about. And he says, "I'm not talking about bread." He said, "Remember when we fed the 5,000, how many baskets of bread were left over? And 12 baskets. And when we fed the 4,000, how many were left over and all?" And he says, "Are you still without understanding?" Now, what he was saying there apparently is, "Don't you understand that I'm not worried about bread? I mean, I can multiply bread. There's no problem there. Don't you remember those cases? Didn't you learn the lesson of the loaves?" In fact, one of the Gospels actually says they didn't understand his meaning because they understood not, or they had not learned the lesson of the loaves. They didn't understand the miracle of the loaves. They had seen wonders, and they rejoiced in them at the time, but they didn't learn a lasting lesson. That is, that God can take care of everything. They didn't learn to really make trusting him for future deliverances an established pattern of thinking. So it says they understood not by wonders in Egypt. Doesn't mean that they failed to appreciate the plagues, but that it didn't really change their habits of thinking. They still didn't learn to trust God through it. And so it says they provoked him at the Red Sea, meaning that before God opened the Red Sea, the Jews were saying, "Moses, did you bring us out here because there weren't enough graves in Egypt to bury us all in? So you brought us out here to die in the wilderness," and so forth. And they were actually complaining against Moses and against God for bringing them to a place that they thought they were going to die in. And that was provoking God, but God was patient with them at that point. It says, "Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make his mighty power to be known. He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it was dried up. So he led them through the depth as through the wilderness. And he saved them from the hand of him that hated them, and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. And the waters covered their enemies. There was not one of them left of the Egyptians. Then believed they his words and sang his praise." In Exodus 15, they came over on the other side. They were believers all of a sudden and for a very short time. And they sang praise unto God on the other side of the sea. But it was only a temporary revival, because it says in verse 13, "They soon forgot his works. They waited not for his counsel, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness unto their soul." Now, this same period of wilderness wandering is mentioned in Psalm 105. There's no mention in Psalm 105 of the reaction of the people, only of God's faithfulness in sending them quails. In verse 40 of the previous Psalm, the people asked, and he brought quails and satisfied them with the bread of heaven. He opened the rock, gave them water. It just shows how God did all these good things for them in the wilderness. But in this Psalm, it recalls the same stories and points out that they got these things from God because they were complaining and because they were upset with God and because they grumbled and they weren't satisfied with him. In verse 13 it says, "They waited not for his counsel." That could mean that they moved ahead of God when he hadn't told them to move, but that doesn't seem to be the meaning in this case. If you think of the story, that's not really what happened. When it says they waited not for his counsel, remember the expression "waiting on God" is frequent in the Psalms. And in one of the Psalms we just read a while ago, Psalm 104, where all the creation has gone through. Remember, the 5 days of creation are gone through, and it talks about the animals particularly that God provides for. In Psalm 104, verse 25, verse 27, it says, "These all wait upon thee, that thou mayest give them meat in due season." That is, all these created things wait on God for food. Waiting on God means then, of course, to look to him. To look to him in expectation, in anticipation of his providing. Basically, to trust him and to be at rest, waiting patiently for him to give in the proper time. That's how the animals are, he says. The birds, the fishes, Leviathan playing in the sea, the animals, they all wait on you to give them their food, he says. Now, in contrast, the Jews in Psalm 106 did not wait on him. That is, they weren't patient. They weren't waiting for his timing, for his counsel. In other words, his the decision he would make about when and how to feed them. They didn't wait on him like the animals did, but they lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. This lusting was after food and after meat, and they cried for quails. And you remember how that God sent them quails, and a plague came upon them because of their gluttonous gobbling down this meat. They hadn't eaten meat for probably months, and they just ravenously consumed this rotting meat that was these dead quails that fell on the ground around them, and a great plague broke out among them. And that's what is referred to in verse 15, where it says, he gave them their request, but sent leanness unto their soul. That is, God gave them the thing they asked for, but it wasn't good for them. Now, that's kind of a frightening thing and an interesting principle of Scripture that applies, I imagine, to all times. That God has told us that if we ask anything according to his will, he heareth us. And if he hears us, we know that we have the petitions that we desired of him. So it says in 5:14. And that's 1 John 5:14. If we ask anything according to his will, he hears us, and we can be guaranteed that he'll give it to us. There is no guarantee that he will give us anything we ask for that is not in his will. But he might, if we're unlucky. A lot of times we ask for things that are not God's will, and the reason they're not his will is because they're not good for us. If they were good for us, it would be his will for us, because his will is good for us. He will not withhold any good thing from those who walk uprightly. But if he's withholding something because it's not good for us, yet we continually beg him and complain that we don't have it and demand that he give it to us, many times, even though it's not his will to do so, he'll give it. And it's more like a disciplinary action on his part. He gives us what we ask for because he knows that it'll teach us a lesson, or it should. At least it's intended to teach us a lesson. In their case, he gave them what they asked for. But it cost them a great deal, as he knew it would. But they were so demanding. They tempted God in the desert and demanded that he give them bread. So he gave them what they asked for, but sent leanness with it. You know, there's a lot of people in the church today who think that God is their errand boy and has to answer every request they have. There are certain scriptures that can be used and are used by Christians of some sorts, which indicate that anything we ask for, we can have. There is a scripture in the 15th chapter of John where Jesus said, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, you may ask what you will, and it shall be done unto you. And there are other scriptures to that effect too. Mark 11:24, whatsoever things you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them and you shall have them. Scriptures like that indicate whatever you want, just ask for it and you can have it. Now, the conditions that are implied are found in other scriptures and sometimes even in the same passages. It makes it clear that only if your desires are godly desires is this promise intended to be binding. That if your desires are godly desires, then you can ask and God will give them to you. But many people have just felt like it's a blanket promise, unconditional. Anything you want, just ask God and you can demand it from him. And there's a whole vein of Christians, a whole movement in the Christian world today of people who have this mentality about prayer. That's just your way of getting your will done by God. It's sort of your way of getting your selfish desires fulfilled and using God as your assistant or your errand boy to get it done for you. And that's how prayer is viewed by a lot of Christians today. And they can even testify that they prayed for, you know, prosperity and God gave them prosperity, you know, and what did they do with it? Well, they went out and bought new cars, new houses, new appliances, new everything. They lived in a way which is clearly not pleasing to God according to the words of Jesus, and yet they can testify that God answered their prayer. They can testify that this really works, that this really is a good thing because God blessed it, and they asked and he gave it to them. But they don't take into consideration that God may give them their request and send with it leanness to their soul. And there are people who God actually disciplines them in a way by giving them their request and testing them. My father-in-law, who has been a millionaire twice in his life, at different times, has made a million on two separate occasions,
is of the opinion that wealth is not a blessing from God. He says it's a test. That when God gives you wealth, it's not to bless you, but to test you and to see what kind of, to see how spiritual you are, really, to see if you'll be a good steward of it or whether you'll be, whether you'll fall into selfish indulgence and all. And he's an interesting character. My wife, it's her father, of course, my wife was telling me that even though he and his wife both have bad eyes, you know, even though he's been a millionaire twice, even when he was a millionaire, he wouldn't go down to an optometrist and get prescription glasses. He'd go down to Woolworth's and buy these magnifying glasses for $3 or something like that, and you know, that are half-size glasses so he could read and watch the news at the same time, you know. But I mean, he buys these cheap glasses and he wears cheap clothes and drives a cheap car, and it's kind of funny. No one would guess by looking at him that he was a millionaire. He's not now, but even when he was a millionaire, that's how he's always lived. And I believe that it's because he understands that if God does give money, it's a test to see if you'll be a good steward or if you'll just become selfish. And in this case, God gave them their request, and it was not good for them. And that's been the case with many Christians. God gives them riches, and it ruins them. It destroys their spiritual life. And it shows us how necessary it is for us to really pray according to the will of God instead of trying to seek prayer as a means of getting our will and our lusts fulfilled. It says in James chapter 4, ye have not because ye ask not, and you ask and receive not because you ask with the wrong motives. You ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lusts. The only thing that's worse than asking according to your lusts and not receiving is asking according to your lusts and receiving. You know, God often will mercifully withhold from you the thing that you're asking for because he knows it's not good for you. But if you pester him enough, he just might give it to you anyway. If you're complaining and you're spirit's bad about it, and you're just trying to manipulate God through, you know, twisting promises of Scripture to try to say God has to do this, God might just say, okay, I'll do it. I'll do what you said. But it's a test and a judgment in many cases, and it doesn't benefit their soul or their spirit. He gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. They envied Moses also in the camp, and Aaron, the saints of the Lord. And the earth opened up and swallowed up Dathan and covered the company of Abiram. This is a reference to the rebellion of Korah. Korah was a Levite who believed that Aaron and Moses were taking too much authority on themselves. He didn't realize that God ordained them, or if he did realize it, he was trying to obscure that fact. And he wanted to have as much authority as they had. And God was angry because, of course, it was God who set up Moses and Aaron, not man who had done so. And so God opened the earth and swallowed up Korah and his companions. Dathan and Abiram, who are mentioned here, were companions of Korah because they envied Moses. So it talks about how God showed them his judgments. And it says, and a fire was kindled in their company, and a flame burned up the wicked. That happened also when the ground opened up, and a fire was in the camp and went through and burned up the houses and families of many of the wicked people who had rebelled. It says, they made a calf in Horeb. Horeb is Mount Sinai, where the law was given. And it was while Moses was on the mountain receiving the law that they made the golden calf. And they worshipped the molten image. Thus they changed their glory into the similitude of an ox that eateth grass. Now this is stated as sort of this statement is made in such a way as should inspire amazement, disgust, you know, that they changed the glory of God into the image of an animal. Paul the Apostle borrowed this very language. In fact, it's no doubt this verse that he was referring to when in Romans chapter 1, he's talking about the decline of those who suppress the truth in unrighteousness and how that they knew God but didn't want to retain the memory of God. It says they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the image of corruptible four-footed beasts and man and so forth, which is obviously a reference to this verse. They changed their glory, meaning God, into the likeness of an ox. It says they forget God, their Savior, which had done great things in Egypt, wondrous works in the land of Ham, and terrible things by the Red Sea. All the things God did for them, they forgot them. It says, therefore he said that he would destroy them,
And had not Moses, his chosen, stood before him in the breach to turn away his wrath, lest he should destroy them, yea, they despised the pleasant land, they believed not his word. I guess I moved too quickly from verse 23 to 24. Verse 23 refers to the fact that when they made the golden calf, God told Moses he was going to destroy the Jews and make a new nation out of Moses himself that would be greater than the nation he had made from already of the Jews. And Moses, being loyal to the promises God had made to Abraham, realized that this would not be good and stood and interceded for the people. Now, that the story gives some people some problems because it sounds like God was planning to break his promise with Abraham and Moses talked him out of it. But in fact, I understand this to mean that God was drawing Moses into a ministry of intercession. He was actually testing Moses to see if Moses would go for this new offer or whether Moses would stand by the promises made earlier. And God very quickly acquiesced to Moses when Moses said, please don't do it. You know, if you're going to destroy them, then blot my name out of your book too. God then said, okay, I'll spare him for your sake. It seems as though God was not needing to be greatly persuaded, but that he basically threatened to do this thing in order to give Moses a chance to intercede and to move into an intercessory ministry. And God responded to him. Then in verse 24, when it says, they despised the pleasant land, that's a reference to the fact when the spies were sent over into Canaan, 10 of them brought back an evil report. Though they agreed it was a pleasant land and full of, as I said, flowing with milk and honey, nonetheless, they despised it. They lightly esteemed it. They didn't desire it because they felt like it would be too costly to try to overcome it. In fact, they felt they couldn't overcome it because of the size and strength of the present inhabitants. So they didn't trust God. They didn't value the land enough to take the risk of trusting God to go in and taking it. So in a sense, they despised or they lightly esteemed the pleasant land. They believed not his word. They murmured in their tents and hearkened not unto the voice of the Lord. That is, his voice had told them, his word had told them that he would give them the land, but they didn't hearken to that. They didn't believe that. They didn't walk in it. Therefore, he lifted up his hand against them to overthrow them in the wilderness, to overthrow their seed also among the nations and to scatter them in the lands. They joined themselves also to Baal Peor. Now, this is during the 40 years of wandering. After they refused to go into the land of Canaan, God turned them back and caused them to wander around another 38 years in the wilderness until their whole generation had died. During that time, the incident of Baal Peor occurred. Now, that has to do with the story of Balaam. You remember how that Balaam was hired by the Moabite king Balak to curse the Jews. And God told Balaam, you can't curse them because they're blessed. But Balak was offering Balaam money to curse them, and he wanted the money. In the New Testament, we're told that Balaam loved the wages of unrighteousness. That is, he loved the money. And therefore, he sought a way to curse them anyway. Every time Balaam stood on a mountain overlooking the Jews and intended to curse them, he went into a trance and blessings came out of his mouth instead of curses. And so that Balak, the king who hired him, said, don't say anything, because every time you try to curse them, you end up blessing them. I hired you to curse them. And Balaam said, I can't say anything except what the Lord gives me. I can't help it. But because Balaam wanted the money, he found a way that he could curse them. He said, instead of me standing over them and cursing them, pronouncing curses, which I can't do because God won't let me, here's what you can do. Send your women down to seduce the Jewish men and to lead them into sexual immorality. And then, through those links that are made with them, draw them into worship of the Canaanite, or of the Moabite god Baal Peor, or Baal. So that's what Balak did. And Balaam said, this way, their own god will curse them. I can't curse them. But if you lead them into idol worship and in fornication, then their own god will curse them. And so your result will be achieved anyway. And so Balaam managed to get paid off anyway. And that's why the New Testament says he loved the wages of unrighteousness. Well, that's what's referred to here, this story of Baal Peor. Now, because of this sin that actually the Jews got led into through the counsel of Balaam, the Moabite women did go in, they began to seduce the men, they began to, rampant fornication was going on, and then idolatry going in to worship Baal and such. God sent a plague among the camp to plague the people, just as Balaam said he would. He sent a curse on the people. But the plague was stopped when Phinehas, the son of Aaron, actually saw two people, an Israelite man and a Moabite woman, going right on into it, into the man's tent in public, just in front of everyone, going into to commit sexual immorality. And Phinehas ran into the tent with a spear and thrust it through both of them while they were in the very act. Rather a gross story, as many of the stories in the Bible are, but they're true stories, and it was actually God was pleased with it. The zeal of Phinehas was spoken in his favor, as we'll see even in this account here, because he stopped the plague. That is, he brought about a representative act of judgment upon the sin that was committed and stopped the sin and the plague, because no one else would then continue doing this. They didn't want to get thrust through also. So Phinehas put the fear of God in the people, and they repented of their sin, and the plague stopped. But in describing this incident at Baal Peor, in verse 28, it says, they joined themselves also into Baal Peor and ate the sacrifices of the dead, probably meaning dead idols, the sacrifices that were made to gods who were not alive. Thus they provoked him, God, to anger with their inventions or with their activities. And the plague broke in upon them. Then stood up Phinehas and executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed or stopped. And that was counted unto him for righteousness unto all generations forevermore. That's an interesting statement in verse 31, that Phinehas' zeal in bringing judgment was counted to him for righteousness. The same words exactly that are said of Abraham, that his faith was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, it's interesting in the New Testament that the Apostle Paul frequently quotes Genesis 15:6, where it says, Abraham believed God and it was accounted him for righteousness, and quotes that to show that we are justified by faith. He never quotes this verse, which is worded almost the same way, where Phinehas was accounted, his zeal was accounted for righteousness with him. And that might seem arbitrary. It might seem like Paul's picking the one Old Testament reference that suits his purpose and ignoring the other one. But there's a reason that he mentions Abraham's being counted righteous by his faith and not mentions Phinehas being accounted righteous for his zeal and his judgment. And that is because Paul is stressing that the benefits that were promised to Abraham have come upon people who've walked in the way Abraham walked, or had the faith of Abraham. It's much more significant the way that Abraham was counted righteous than the way Phinehas was, because Phinehas is not, no special promises were made to Phinehas or to his seed. The covenants weren't made with that man, and therefore his children were just one of the lesser families, or they were one of the priestly families, but just one of the many families in Israel, whereas all Israel came from Abraham. And Paul is stressing that the true children of Abraham, the true children of the covenant, are those who were accounted righteous in the same way Abraham was. There'd be no point in stressing the fact that Phinehas was counted righteous for his zeal. And we are not told to imitate the zeal of Phinehas in judging sinners. We're not supposed to go thrusting spears through fornicators in our day. In fact, the Bible says in 1 Corinthians 5, we're not even supposed to be standing in judgment of them. He says if they're in the church, then we should judge them. But Paul says, what have I to do to judge those who are outside the church? God judges them. But the point is that Phinehas showed that he had a right heart toward God and a zeal for God by thrusting these people through. And that was counted to him for righteousness. That is, it was spoken in his favor. His righteousness was seen in that act. But he is not set forward as an example to us of us being counted righteous in the way he was, but the way that Abraham was is much more applicable to our own situation, as Paul points out in his writings. It says in verse 32, they angered him also at the waters of strife, or of Meribah. That's where water was given from the rock. Now see, we see all these cases where they angered God. They lusted for flesh in verse 14. They made a calf in verse 19. They joined themselves to Baal Peor in verse 28. Now in verse 32, they angered him at the waters of strife, complaining that God had brought them out of the wilderness. They died. They didn't have water. So that it went ill with Moses for their sakes, because they provoked his spirit so that he spake unadvisedly with his lips. What this means is that Moses got so fed up with the complaining of these people, after God had shown them so many mercies, yet they kept complaining against God and rebelling against God, Moses got so fed up that even though God told him to just go out and speak to the rock the second time, he went out in anger and did not contain himself and didn't speak to the people with the same composure and all that God intended for him to. And instead he smote the rock, said, do I have to smite this rock again? And he smote it. And later God pulled him aside and said, Moses, that wasn't what I told you to do. And it went ill for Moses because he wasn't allowed to go into the promised land because of that. But the writer here indicates, of course, Moses suffered this ill destiny because the people provoked him, because of the rebelliousness of the people. It says they provoked his spirit so that he spoke unadvisedly with his lips. And therefore, for their sake, it went ill with Moses. So even though Moses had been used of God to really bring deliverance to them and had laid his life down so many times for them and had even interceded for them when God was going to wipe them out, they owed so much to Moses. He was like a father with 3 million children, you know, that he was raising and trying to lead them and trying to give them good leadership and trying to keep them safe and all. Yet their rebellion even got him in trouble. And so for all his favor that he had shown to the Israelites, they got him into trouble by provoking him to speak unadvisedly, and then it went ill for him. Then it says, verse 34, they did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them. Now, that's after the days of Moses, when Joshua led the people into Canaan. They destroyed enough nations to actually occupy all the land. That's true. But they left some nations standing. For instance, the Jebusites in Jerusalem remained there until several centuries later when David wiped them out. David lived probably 3 or 4 centuries after Joshua's time. And during those centuries, the Jebusites, who were Canaanites, still inhabited Jerusalem. And there were many other Canaanite tribes that were not fully wiped out. The Jews went in, and instead of doing what God said, wiping out all the Canaanites, they wiped out just enough to inhabit their cities, wherever they wanted to inhabit. They took over. But once they had a place of rest, once they had come to a place where they felt comfortable, they just kind of didn't want to go out to war anymore. So they let the other Canaanites dwell peacefully among them, which God told them not to do. And God warned them that if they did leave the Canaanites in the land at all, that those Canaanites would lead them into their idolatrous religions, which is exactly what happened and what's reported here. Because it says, they did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them, but were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. That's what God said would happen. And they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. So we see again and again and again the failure and disobedience of the people to live up to what God told them to do in spite of all his goodness to them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters to devils. The sacrificing of their own children on altars to Molech is something so abominable that it's hard for us to realize that people ever did such thing, especially people that would be considered civilized, people who had laws and everything like the Jews had. Yet they did it. And it just shows how deep man can fall into depravity without God's intervention. I mean, even with God's intervention of giving them laws and judgments, still they fell into that depth of depravity. That's what the Canaanites did. They worshiped Molech. They burned their children alive in the arms of this brass statue, their babies, and offered infant sacrifices. And the Jews actually got involved in that kind of thing because they didn't wipe the Canaanites out. They became attracted to that religion. You might say, well, why would people be attracted to a horrible demonic religion like that? The answer is because it was fleshly and spiritual. It had demons behind it, which were very seductive and drew people into their practices. You might wonder why people go out and get drunk and destroy their lives that way, or go out and become heroin addicts or take PCP or anything else that's going to destroy their minds permanently or something. Why would people do that? Obviously, they're not thinking rationally. They're being drawn irrationally by spiritual deception and spiritual powers. And that's what drew people into this. Also, there was a lot of immorality associated with the worship of Moloch, a lot of orgies and all. And so the flesh, that appealed to the flesh more than the pure, holy religion that God put before them too. So those things led the Jews into this kind of horrible infant sacrifice to Moloch. So they shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and their daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. Thus were they defiled with their own works, and went a-whoring with their own inventions. This expression, going whoring after other gods, is found in the prophets frequently. It refers to the concept that the Jews were supposed to be God's wife, so to speak. He was a husband to them, and they were his wife. Therefore, their worship was due only to him. Just like a wife is supposed to only have sexual relations with her husband and with no one else, so the Jews were supposed to only have worship toward Jehovah and none else. But they actually went whoring, like a wife who would go out and have sexual relations with another man. They did that. They had worship toward other gods. Therefore, they were prostitutes, adulteresses, the nation became adulterous. Spiritual adultery is referred to in the prophets frequently, and it's always referring to this fact that they worshiped other gods and violated their covenant with their husband, the true God. Let's see, what verse was that? That was verse 39. So verse 40, therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance, his own people. And he gave them into the hand of the heathen. This would be the Babylonian captivity. And they that hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. Or, I'm sorry, this is not yet the Babylonian captivity. It gets to that. But this is actually during the other shorter captivities, during the days of the judges. You remember the story of the judges, that because of the Jews' idolatry, God would bring up the Philistines, the Moabites, or the Midianites, or some other tribe that would oppress them for a period of time until the judges would rise up. And that's what this is referring to. He gave them into the hand of the heathen. They that hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. Many times did he deliver them, and they provoked him with their counsel, and they were brought low for their iniquity. Nevertheless, he regarded their affliction, and when he heard their cry, that is, every time they seemed to repent, he sent a judge to deliver them and gave them a period of freedom again, and then they'd sin again and so forth, to follow the same cycle. Nevertheless, it says, and he remembered for them his covenant and repented according to the multitude of his mercies. He made them also to be pitied of all those that carried them captives. This would be the Babylonian captivity. After they were carried captive into Babylon, the Persians who conquered Babylon then showed pity on them and gave them a chance to go back to their own land. So he says that God was faithful, even in that when he sent punishment on them, he caused even their captors to show pity on them, as he did Cyrus, the Persian king, who pitied them and sent them free. That certainly skips past the days of the judges, because the oppressors in those days didn't show pity on them. But later it was the Babylonians, conquerors, the Persians, who showed pity on them and sent them home. Then he ends with a prayer. Save us, O Lord our God, and gather us from among the heathen. Apparently they were still, many of them, in scattered from the Babylonian captivity at the time of this writing. To give thanks unto thy holy name, and to triumph in thy praise. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel from everlasting to everlasting, and let all the people say, Amen. Praise ye the Lord. As you might have guessed, this is the close of another one of the five books. This is the end of the fourth book. So that Psalm 107 begins the fifth, the longest and final book of the Psalms, which we will get into when we come back from our break.